Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We're in paper 96, section 7, which is old single column, page 1060. So we have this final section of this paper entitled Yahweh, God of the Hebrews. Recall, as I was pointing out at the end of the session last week, this paper just rolls right over into the next one. they've just divided the subject matter of laying out the details with the Hebrew people, the Jewish people. They've broken it up into this sort of predicate part, and then basically the linear sequence of the prophets that follow in this established context, basically the Mosaic context that they're setting up for you in this paper. And I think maybe the only thing else we need to say is just how at the end of section 6, they were leading us into this final section where they're going to talk about the book of Job. Because, if you look at that last paragraph in section 6, remember how we were talking about the immediate times after Moses was gone? First with Joshua, and then that long span, kind of in the wilderness, as it were, for the Hebrew people with the so-called judges. And so when you're looking at that final paragraph there, it's got a bunch of quotes, and it starts out with a quote from Joshua, the book of Joshua. But then it's got some other quotes, and see, remember the context there. It says, but even in this dark age, every now and then a solitary teacher would arise proclaiming the Mosaic concept of divinity. Well, those other quotes are from the book of Job. And so we'll see as we get into this next section that, besides those sheikhs, those so-called judges, you continue to have, as they're indicating there, this occasional injection of what's come down from Melchizedek into those times. Injecting a little bit more focus and upliftment into those people's concepts of deity, divinity, God, whatever you might say. Between the lines, in other words, they were transitioning you into this section. And you've got, remember that you've got the sequence of books in the Old Testament take you through some of that early history before they jump in with giving you books like Job and Psalms and Proverbs and what have you there, those wisdom books. So even though, those books aren't ahead of some of that history, like with Samuel in the Old Testament, they are a predicate. Remember how they told you that, really the sacred text for those very ancient Hebrews was that Book of Wisdom, some of which got into the Book of Proverbs. So they're trying to give you what that general kind of more evolutionary context is for the Hebrew people. Before the Melchizedek receivers start tweaking things, you know, very repetitively with that sequence of prophets. Okay. All right, so, and of course, remember we talked about Psalms and how significant Ignaton was, for instance, for a lot of the Psalms. Okay, so let's see what they say here.
Section 7, Psalms in the Book of Job. Under the leadership of their sheikhs and priests, the Hebrews became loosely established in Palestine. But they soon drifted back into the benighted beliefs of the desert and became contaminated with the less advanced Canaanite religious practices. They became idolatrous and licentious, and their idea of deity fell far below the Egyptian and Mesopotamian concepts of God that were maintained by certain surviving Salem groups and which are recorded in some of the Psalms and in the so-called Book of Job.
They'll explain a little bit more, if you don't know already, why they're saying so-called there with the Book of Job. As you might guess, it probably isn't a precise historical record of a guy named Job. Right, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but any more than the first five books, the Pentateuch of the Old Testament are written by the hand of Moses. You see, they're just reminding you of what they were just talking about in the preceding section. You've gotten into, some very basal evolutionary states again. Not a lot of inner light going on. I think they just said dark age, back there in the paragraph we were just looking at. When we hear things like idolatrous and licentious, you have all of the moralism of Christianity and whatnot that you think of when you hear words like that, but remember, it just means that you're going back to the more, the less structured, normal state of affairs. Basic evolutionary culture, when it isn't so predicated on the upper domain of your mind, just doesn't have a lot of stark lines that are drawn. So licentious, license, that in other words, licentious, the sense that you have permission to do lots of things that in a more, locked down system, you don't have permission to do hardly anything. Everything is very minutely, bounded and prescribed for you. So, don't immediately, think sexual, sorts of mores with licentious. Just, think of it more in general. And the fact that you can call a license a permit, right? I mean, the word license just means permit. So licentious means permission. That you're just assuming that you've got lots of permission to do things. And we saw with Moses that, the natural thing is the fetish concept, that later became such a no-no and, it's called graven images, idols, right? But it's actually just the basic, essentially innocent, immature children of God doing what comes naturally, okay?
Whichever one is convenient to justify what you want to do.
You're just kind of going with your natural animal origin desires, and you aren't superimposing some sort of, I want to do this, but, I believe that the spirits, want otherwise, remember how that was the normal mode of conceiving of what spirits were up to. Spirits were just innately antithetical to whatever it comes naturally for you, right? Because they'd like to see you suffer, you know, and so anything that would be pleasurable for you, oh, that's forbidden, you know, by the spirits, because, boy, they just love to see you squirm and suffer and whatnot. Right, so, you start out with very arbitrary taboos, lines, boundaries that are drawn, but nonetheless, it's progress, no matter how arbitrary it is, that you are starting to try to bring structure, order into your culture, right? And not just have it be, the whatever goes of the horde, right? Think about how permissive, how licentious, right, the horde state of things is, right? I mean, it's just sort of just, whatever comes naturally, like the cows out in the field, right? So there's just not much structure at all that you're working in initially.
Chris?
Yep.
I happened to just read about that. Mm-hmm. And along those lines, they were saying we need to have more and more self-control according to, I don't think they used the word regulation, but they didn't say mores, but it's about the same thing, mm-hmm. according to what our mores are. So, we do have our setup of how it needs to be at this time.
And it starts as just the mores, but you just keep lifting those mores up until it actually becomes genuine morals, that you're framing yourself with.
So it would be kind of the opposite of licentious, I think, as we evolve.
Right, you can bring the word licentious up the ladder, right, and give it more and more objective significance. But initially it starts out, it's pretty arbitrary, low level, but yeah, I mean, it's an appropriate word. I'm just trying to point out, don't overplay it here, right? This is just they were in that state forever, and Moses tried to prop them up a little bit, as soon as he's gone, it's just going to go back down to the natural state again. Okay, let's see. Anything else we need to say up there up front? Notice they mention, you'll see this as we go forward. You've got this very very small, localized structure units. It's clans, or tribes at best, with the tribal sheik. Right, I mean, you don't have any sort of a monarchical, extensive, nation-like thing happening here. And that could be a problem, because they're in the midst of some peoples, right, in the Near East there that spin up some pretty significant phenomena, right? And so this whole notion of going to the Promised Land, how are you going to hold on to that Promised Land if you're just a ragtag bunch of, tribal warlords and stuff? So that's, there's that political, issue beneath the surface here, too. All right.
The Psalms are the work of a score or more of authors. Many were written by Egyptian and Mesopotamian teachers. During these times when the Levant worshipped nature gods, there were still a goodly number who believed in the supremacy of El Elyon, the Most High.
And notice that they just reminded you that there's some reality to it by saying goodly. Right? They're just subtly reminding you that there's some relationship to an upper domain and genuine spiritual nature, goodness. Those people like that are a goodly number. We've not only Akhenaten, right? This is the source of some of the Psalms, with other Egyptian Mesopotamian individuals, right? And they all get, recast as Jewish authors, but, when all is said and done, it's constructing the Old Testament. And, that reminds you that, obviously some of these, way predate the immediacy of the time of the judges that we're talking about here. But it's also, they're going to be being generated through that time too. All right.
When they say worship nature gods, don't forget Yahweh starts out as a nature god.
Don't forget that little point. All right.
No collection of religious writings gives expression to such a wealth of devotion and inspirational ideas as God, of God, as the Book of Psalms. And it would be very helpful if, in the perusal of this wonderful collection of worshipful literature, consideration could be given to the source and chronology of each separate hymn of praise and adoration, bearing in mind that no other single collection covers such a great range of time. This Book of Psalms is the record of the varying concepts of God entertained by the believers of the Salem religion throughout the Levant, and embraces the entire period from Amenemope to Isaiah. In the Psalms, God is depicted in all phases of conception, from the crude idea of a tribal deity to the vastly expanded ideal of the later Hebrews, wherein Yahweh is pictured as a loving ruler and merciful father.
So, in other words, what are they telling you? If you want to get the most out of this Book of Psalms, right, you can get a lot if you just approach it with your spiritual consciousness. But they're saying there's more to be gotten from the Book of Psalms if you approach it with cosmic consciousness, which means you bring in your material consciousness, you know, so that you think about the source and the chronology of each separate hymn of praise and adoration, as they say there, right? To bring in that that consideration of the details, right? Of it, the factual details of it, will actually increase what you can get out of it when you. When you take something for what it is rather than what it isn't, you obviously can get more out of it, right? There's going to be a psalm. Okay, it's not written by Second Isaiah sort of mentality, but that doesn't mean you can't appreciate it. You can read that prayer of Anagar. You know Anagar is there almost a million years ago. You know what his situation is in the midst of the Ice Age and everything, and how primitive with all the back meeting and whatnot. But you can take all those material consciousness considerations into play, then bring in your spiritual consciousness, and you can get a lot more out of that prayer. See, they're telling you the same thing here. So stop treating everything in Psalms or everything in the Old Testament as all, you know, at the same point in time, or the same quality of mind or whatnot. Look at it more objectively, more with a fatherly consciousness mind, right? Where they're all children, and there's a beauty in where they are, even if it's at a very beginning stage.
I always had a hard time making hide or hair out of the Psalms. Uh-huh. You know, reading through them, what are they talking about?
Right. There's a,
not easy.
Especially if some of them have a lot of kind of Jewish context to them. If you don't appreciate that, it comes off kind of odd, you know. They're telling you. I mean, you have to be able to strike step with some of those analytic details, if you will, of it. So that those don't become a stumbling block, and then in that frame, no matter how small the frame, you can appreciate it better, right? You can see, like I said, for what it is instead of what it isn't.
Well, they're not suggesting that the order that we know them is the chronological order. So you almost have to study the Psalms and reflect on them to put them in a proper order.
Right. You see, and at the very least. They're challenging scholars to do that so that eventually those who can't do that themselves could benefit from that proper chronological ordering, reflecting on them, seeing which ones are obviously more beginning ones. You know, they gave you a clue that the first one is a Metamorphoses, which is kind of interesting. So that kind of just tells you that whoever put them in that order maybe has some sense of what the older ones were and the newer ones. You know, you might be able to go by it a little bit. But, there's a lot that properly framed scholars could achieve. And that's the problem on the planet. We got lots of scholars, but no properly framed scholars. And so they're all working with the minutiae in a false context. And boy, if you could just recontextualize these analytic engines, they could produce a lot of quality scientific product that someone who is just motivated by their spiritual consciousness, you could unwittingly benefit from. Right? Things would improve, even if the humans involved don't improve that much. Yeah, that's the whole point of the book, you know, is that we don't have that leadership with a quality of mind that can frame things, contextualize things for those who just can't do that yet, because most of us are just not that profound in our mentality. Right? But if you have the leaders that put things in the context for you, you have an encirclement of the Holy Spirit. The common person can achieve actually pretty amazing things if they just have a little bit of assistance. Like me, having the assistance of the Urantia book and thinking way beyond my innate abilities because of it.
It's kind of interesting that they can't tell you stuff you already know or whatever, but the fact that they're telling us in a way that this is such a long period of time. Whenever I used to read them and going to Bible school or stuff like that, I always thought they were, in one short period.
Right.
I had no idea that.
Yeah.
It makes a whole lot more sense that they're spread out over a whole lot, much longer period of time, because they don't really go together sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, the Old Testament itself is spread out over a long span of time, but the Psalms, even more so.
Yeah.
Right. Way before Moses, it starts, right? Yeah. In those contexts. I remember they were talking thousands and thousands of years, BC, some of that stuff. Yeah. So,
I mean, if you take Adam and Eve, which starts out, as being 38,000, 9,000 years ago versus, 6,000 years ago or whatever they were saying, it's a whole different, it's a much longer period of time.
Even if you didn't have the details, even if you just knew in reading them that they span this great span of time and a great diversity of approaches to God, if you just knew that, to think broadly and in multiple approach vectors, if you just had that basic concept in mind as you were reading it, even if you couldn't put them in chronological order or anything like that, you would just be more open to kind of going with the flow of the particular psalm you were in.
Yeah.
And finding what you could out of it. Like I said, just being able to set aside the irrelevant details,
And Jesus had them all memorized, right?
Yeah.
They all did. That's,
of course,
Sat and repeated, yeah.
They could, remember when Jesus is young and his parents, as they're traveling, they're recounting all the things that happened here, and whatnot. I mean, they know the Hebrew scriptures very well. Right? And that's just Mary and Joseph, right? Anything else there that? You remember? We talked about the Metamorphoses. When they say to Isaiah, remember they mean up to the exile in the 6th century BC. I think we got everything. Oh, just noticing a tribal deity, lowercase d deity, in other words, it goes back to stuff that, all right, it's not really worthy of even using capital letters for God or deity or anything, right? Some of it is so kind of primitive and natural. But nonetheless, right, there's a little child of God who is trying there to express the reverence that they felt. Right?
And when thus regarded, this group of psalms constitutes the most valuable and helpful assortment of devotional sentiments ever assembled by man up to the times of the 20th century. The worshipful spirit of this collection of hymns transcends that of all other sacred books of the world.
Yeah, and those of you who are familiar with the book, remember how stunning, you know, and how unqualified a statement you have here about the Book of Psalms.
So what happened in the 20th century? Your answer book?
Yeah, up to the times of the writing, they're telling you, yes. Right. Not as if when we got into the Endarkment of the 20th century, there's this great collection of things that transcends the Psalms. heavens, no. Who needs Ignaton now that you've got the 20th century thinkers? So they put that little footnote in there just to put greater emphasis on what we were saying up front. There's a lot to be gained just from something as ancient in many ways as Psalms. Right? You talk about, what this person needs is a fifth epical revelation. No, maybe what they just need is Psalms. Or like you've heard me say before, we're talking about a Metamopi. Maybe what they just need is Proverbs. Right? I mean, one of those two books, I mean, if everyone on the planet was well synchronized with the truths that flow through those, just those two books, forget about the rest of the Bible, forget about Jesus and everything, it would completely transform the entire planet. It would be revolutionary, just that. Because like we're reading here, you would get people to a degree up to the third epical revelation. And who knows what we could do then, like maybe the fourth, maybe the fifth, right? But when you don't even have the context of the third, you don't have, the evolutionary context that Melchizedek was trying to bring to a focus as a foundation, what do you have? You've got, as they said back here, even in this dark age, you've got a dark age. That's all you've got. You've just got the natural darkness of man as an animal origin creature. It's nothing to write home about. All right. What about the Book of Job?
The variegated picture of deity presented in the Book of Job was the product of more than a score of Mesopotamian religious teachers extending over a period of almost 300 years. And when you read the lofty concept of divinity found in this compilation of Mesopotamian beliefs, you will recognize that it was in the neighborhood of Ur of Chaldea that the idea of a real God was best preserved during the dark days in Palestine.
Yeah, so again, we see how it's so important that there's this residual reserve of andite. Even if it isn't so much genetically, it's at least andite culture that people are challenging themselves to maintain in southern Mesopotamia, in Ur of Chaldea. How important that is. I mean, it's sort of the pilot light of the world, right? When everything else goes dark, there's that little pilot light there that can still send out, right, some illumination and get things going again. It was extremely important that there was sort of that, that little nook down there that even during all the chaos when the Noddites were going their various directions because they couldn't get along, those Sumerian Nadites could just, oh, we'll just stay down here out of sight, out of mind, you know, while you guys kill yourself and run off to the four corners and whatnot. So it's very interesting little coincidentally in the geography of the history of this planet that there was that little nook that things could be maintained, there could be a residual in. And here you see, like I was hinting at the end of the preceding section, so you know, a lot of the content of Job is really from the times of the judges, those, you know, 3 centuries or so there, between Joshua and Samuel. You can put, you know, Job, you know, in that context, but you know, they're reminding you it's it embodies this this more enlightened nature. You know, like even them saying the idea of a real God was best preserved. You know, as we talk about so many times, yeah, not the ghost cult God that you upload, but the real God that you download or can possibly download. That real God, you know, whether it's the elements in Egypt or there in Chaldea, the Andite culture is holding on to a little bit more of a top-down perspective.
I think that's one of the big problems in the world today, as they don't have a real good concept of the idea of a real God. And so therefore, as people get more intelligent and more logical, the God that they have a concept isn't real.
Right. They can tell it's not a reality. It's illogical. It's, you know, superstitious. It's primitive. It's silly. Right. Yeah. Anyone with any sophistication of mind is going to reject that for what it is. Right? But there's no voice to say, yeah, okay, you've properly rejected the ghost cult God, but what about the real God?
There isn't.
No one says that. Yeah. And again, just if there was just that one little simple message out there, right? You don't have to explain what the real God is. Just ask them, well, what about the real God? See, I mean, and inside of every one of us by grace, there's a super conscious awareness of the real God. You know, and if you just get someone to pause for a second and unwittingly reflect,
what real God? What are you talking about?
Right, it can go, oh, wait a minute. I don't know, there's something about that feels non-arbitrary. There's something I think I can almost hold on to something. What is that? Right? That's all it takes, you know, for many people. It's just some simple little thing where they can become aware of what is there in their mind by grace. Because when you just are focused on what's going on out here, blah, 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 all the fanciness out here, it just doesn't come around inside. Right? You have to get someone to kind of close their eyes to, you know, what's out there for a second and let that natural reflecting state spin up don't be surprised if something actually happens in them. Even something that someone you never would have imagined, you know, could go there. Now, the flip side, we're in a culture that's very aggressive against any validity here. So, and that's why there's an emergency, remember. I mean, it's if only it was just a situation that could be corrected for someone saying, oh, have you considered? Oh, no, I haven't. you got a lot of willful blindness going on, right? And none so blind as those who will not see. Don't overplay what I'm saying here. I mean, there's a lot of people that you can develop a very close personal relationship with them, get into some philosophic conversations with them, seem to find the perfect opportunity where you can kind of get them to say, are you curious? And they go, no. Right? So, you know, that's a difficult state. But you know, don't, it's not hopeless. There are some people that aren't willfully blind, right? They're just, ignorant.
I think they're just afraid.
Yeah.
They're
a little afraid.
Because if I know, then maybe it's going to change me. And for a lot of people, they're just you know, too lazy to do that, or they don't really have a perspective on, well, eternity or universe career, or what am I here for?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's another thing I ask people. Have you ever wondered why you're here?
Yeah.
What you're doing here?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got to get a job.
What's the purpose of existence? Yeah. All right, so, you know, so now even though the book of Job, has a lot of complexity to it, you know, that Psalms doesn't have, like they were just talking about, you know, they are pointing out that when all is said and done with the book of Job, as they're about to kind of explain a little bit more, there are some solid little elements to help kind of pull you out of the morass of confusion. Yeah, I think a lot of you know that's kind of the way the story flows. It kind of lays out all of this confusion, and then a light of clarity penetrates through the fog. Right? So it too has a lot to offer, and it, you know, the Book of Job has played a significant role in the evolution of Western civilization. Just like the Book of Psalms has, and the Book of Proverbs, because of just exactly what we're stressing. Right? There's some very solid, foundational, civilizing impulses to be found within those texts that could carry us a long ways, even without any Jesus or your Rancho book at all. Right?
In Palestine, the wisdom and all-pervasiveness of God was often grasped, but seldom his love and mercy. The Yahweh of these times, quote, sends evil spirits to dominate the souls of his enemies, unquote. He prospers his own and obedient children while he curses and visits dire judgment upon all others. Quote, he disappoints the devices of the crafty. He takes the wise in their own deceit. Unquote.
Yeah, and we, you know, occasionally when we'll bring up these times, you know, and you can even see it some in the Book of Job, you know, remember that you actually have some pre-dual spiritism, you know, stuff going on, you know, so that you, yeah, you know, things like sends evil spirits to dominate the souls of his enemies. See, that's a modality when you don't have a definitive dual spiritism where it's all good on this side and all bad on this side. You know, the two are interplayed. Right? So, you know, so God, you know, is not only the source of good luck, he's also the source of bad luck. So, you know, that's one of the interesting things about the Book of Job is you can see that, you know, fairly directly in places, and they're mentioning, you know, in other spots, you know, too, from those, you know, it's even kind of a dark time in a relative terms if you haven't gotten to dual spiritism yet, no matter how foolish dual spiritism is, it's a step forward from having it all confused and muddled together, right? Until you separate good from bad, how are you ever going to get to the real God? Is absolutely, you know, purely good. Right? You've got to get him completely de-anthropomorphized and separated from, you know, the bottom-up stuff. It's just reminding you that when you're looking at some of the very judgmental God ideas in the Old Testament, some of that is actually kind of just modified pre-dual spiritism stuff where you've got to have God being the baddie also, right? It's not just because they were focusing on power, you know, and awesomeness, and, you know, so that he's, you know, the ferocious volcano god and stuff like that, right? And it's not just that. Some of it is actually, you know, that pre-dual spiritism phenomenon. Okay?
Only at Ur did a voice arise to cry out the mercy of God, saying, quote, he shall pray to God and shall find favor with him and shall see his face with joy, for God will give to man divine righteousness, unquote. Thus from Ur there is preached salvation, divine favor, by faith. Quote, he is gracious to the repentant and says, deliver him from going down in the pit, for I have found a ransom. If any say, I have sinned and perverted that which was right, and it profited me not, God will deliver his soul from going into the pit, and he shall see the light, unquote. Not since the times of Melchizedek had the Levantine world heard such a ringing and cheering message of human salvation as this extraordinary teaching of Elihu, the prophet of Ur and priest of the Salem believers, that is, the remnant of the one-time Melchizedek colony in Mesopotamia.
Okay, so here's, he comes in a fun little tidbit of clarification in the Urantia book about the book of Job. So you remember how you've got the three friends of Job that are giving him all this interesting advice, right? And then along towards the end, there's this fourth person, this younger person that comes into the story, Elihu. They're saying, you know, despite the fact that the scholars look at it and think, oh, he must just be a, you know, a literary device and just a construct. It's like, no, he was a real person. Okay? And he was one of the exemplary individuals holding on to the Melchizedek teachings.
They called him a prophet.
Yes, and, right, I was just going to get to that. Notice that, right? The prophet of Ur. So not only is he an exemplary individual holding on to the Melchizedek teachings, remember how it kind of didn't go very well in Mesopotamia, but, you know, there was a residual thing they mentioned before. He's even being engaged by the celestials, you know, I mean, the Melchizedek receivers are coordinating all this and maybe even doing it themselves, you know, the engaging. So, yeah, he's a real prophet. So, boy, does that change, you know, the scholarly rationalization schemes about the book of Job. But we've seen this before. I mean, several times in various places in the world, they've already pointed out that an individual that has over the centuries has become the most kind of diffused historically, and now scholars, you know, think, you know, I'll bet you there never was a Lao Tzu, right? Or things. You know, we've seen that a number of times. Yeah, here again, right? And the scholars look at the book of Job, you know, like there really was an Elihu. And the revelators flip that right on its head, right? Where you least expect a real historical figure, they tell you he was, right? And a very significant one, way beyond anything that any of your records would ever indicate. Our records are scant about Melchizedek, and they kind of hint at something mysterious, but, you know, little did, you know, do we know historically just how significant, you know, that individual really was, right? That's a lot more than just some priest, you know, wandering around in Palestine, right? So that's kind of a fun thing that they often do here, give you these little vignettes of, oh, wow, really? That was an individual that was being directly worked with and saw to it when all was said and done that there was, there was some enlightenment being injected into the confusion of that story in the book of Job. Yeah, so fun stuff like that. Little disclosures of history. This is a coordination of essential knowledge, right, going on. And it allows, see, again, just like we're talking about with the Psalms, if you coordinate the essential knowledge better with the Psalms, you can find truth there that you couldn't find otherwise. Right? There's some key things that if you know, right, can open it up to a whole depth that was inaccessible before. Right? Now, and if it's true for the book of Psalms or the book of Job, how much more is that true of the fifth epic of Revelation? And if you can get yourself properly coordinated, what might you find, right, in terms of a living relationship just lying there dormant, waiting for you to strike step with it?
Even what you find on the surface is plenty.
Right, right. And the surface is so plenty, so complicated, that that coordination is not easy to achieve. Right? You got to get a whole bunch of ducks in a row all at the same time. Right? It's a very complex phenomenon. And it keeps throwing things at you that you think you know. You know, and that's really problematic because, of course, you don't. And so that is a big blind spot, you know, that you're dragging around. Right. I mean, the most insidious things in the book are the things you think you know what they're talking about, not the things that you can't figure out what they're talking about. Right. There's a lot of danger, false domination potential in those things that you think you know.
Yeah, the Job story is almost like the thief on the cross.
Mm-hmm.
The forgiveness, you know, it's kind of a very empty. What's one of the great stories for people?
Yeah.
Especially in the end, you know, when he finally realized.
Right. And you finally get that transcendence of the material to some degree and recognize the great gift that you have internally, spiritually, right? That is utterly independent, transcendent of all, you know, whether the material is quote-unquote good or bad, right? We might as well mention it, because, you know, when you get going with the prophets, you've got these names that start with E-L-I, you know, like Elijah,
not like Steve.
And that, remember the L, right? You know, that's that generic God name,
yeah.
Right? And the I is you know, indicating specificity to you. So instead of just God, but my God. I mean, that one basically means he is my God. The H-U part. See, which is kind of interesting. It's kind of not very specific, but you know, I think about the small set of words that Jesus reminded Nathaniel and Thomas about with the ideal, in contrast to the idea of God, the ideal of his infinite and eternal nature. And there's the infinite part, the eternal part, and the his part. You know, in the sense that the Urantia book uses that, you know, to indicate transcendence. Like the Father is the God of transcendence. Right? So, see, embodied in his recognition, see, in his name, is that recognition, right, that Machaventa tried to get people to think about as, you know, lifting up off the plane, right, and thinking about a more transcendent God concept, Most High, right? So that's kind of an interesting one, that it actually reminds you of the way male and female is used in the Urantia book. You know, like we're all sons of God, not because we're all males. You know, that sort of thing is kind of inherent in that name. It's kind of interesting. We'll get to Elijah and Elisha later on. You know, that same construct starting off ELI.
And thus did the remnants of the Salem missionaries in Mesopotamia maintain the light of truth during the period of the disorganization of the Hebrew peoples until the appearance of the first of that long line of teachers of Israel, who never stopped as they built, concept upon concept, until they had achieved the realization of the ideal of the universal and creator father of all, the acme of the evolution of the Yahweh concept, presented by Melchizedek of Nebadon.
So obviously that paragraph transitions you to the next paper, as we already hinted at. I would just highlight there a couple things. Yeah. Reminding you, we're talking about the Melchizedek missionaries, the Salem missionaries, and even in Mesopotamia, there's residuals of that. So, you know, we just don't want to ever forget, as we're reading through all this, you get down in all the details and stuff, that none of this story would be playing out, basically, if it wasn't for Machaventa. Right? You've got some tiny little bit of pre-Machaventa Andite wisdom framing, but any, you know, helping to distill any sort of a real God nucleus, religious nucleus out of that, it just wouldn't have been happening without Machaventa. And then the other thing there, during the period of the disorganization of the Hebrew peoples, you know, that's what we were talking about up front with Licentius saying, see, that's the key. Right? It's not just a matter of not, you know, being on fire about God or something like that, all, you know, zealous, all amped up. You need that philosophic framing so that there's order. And, you know, times in the book when they talk about, degeneracy, you know, and things like that. Remember, one of the things they bring up is antisocial. You know, and that in very, very stark negative terms, right? That it's not something, oh, well, they had a little bit of antisocial, whatever. It's like, no, that's a poison, right? Because, you have individuals who are assailing the framework of order, of civilization itself. And that's just not, you can't be allowed, right? You can't have that. That needs to be dealt with very definitively. Doesn't mean you have to execute people, okay, necessarily, but you can't be wishy-washy about some of these things. It's extremely important.
I'd have to execute a few people.
you might have to take a very direct approach with some. Yes. But yeah, we have a harder and harder time being definitive. And I'm teeing this up because we're about to get into the first prophets. These aren't fuzzy mystics. These guys are, they go right at it. There's plenty of material pragmatism in play. They aren't just all fuzzy and wishful thinking. And it's kind of startling to where we are right now as a people. And we've all been kind of raised in a pretty mushy sort of a culture. We have a hard time with sharp lines and definitive leaders and, you know, these sorts of things like we talk about a lot. So, gird thy loins, you know, as we start to read about Samuel and others here. Because they're gonna see to some order. They're gonna straighten people out, you know, and they do old school and that's straightening things out. Right. All right. So let's see what we got here in the next paper.
Paper 97. Evolution of the God concept among the Hebrews. The spiritual leaders of the Hebrews did what no others before them had ever succeeded in doing. They deanthropomorphized their God concept without converting it into an abstraction of deity, comprehensible only to philosophers. Even common people were able to regard the matured concept of Yahweh as a father, if not of the individual, at least of the race.
Okay, so what are they reminding you of there? So, you know, what did we see, you know, so much of in other places in the world when you tried to push things forward from a very primitive state?
To an absolute.
Right, they de-anthropomorphized their God concept without converting it into an abstraction of deity comprehensible only to philosophers, right? Not just some totally fuzzed out Brahman concept or something, right? That's the great gift, you know, that there is, they're pointing out to you right up front, that the Hebrews offer to the whole evolutionary process, the evolution of the God concept here among the Hebrews, is that they manage to be an evolutionary phenomenon with some definitive progressing quality without just kind of fuzzing out. How do you do that? How do you not fuzz out? Well, you manage, for whatever reason, to keep some individuality consciousness in play, right? As you start to bring in more spiritual consciousness. Because if all you have is that unity consciousness, that spiritual consciousness, or mostly that, yeah, you're going to fuzz out. You're going to go into the continuumness, right, of like Brahman. That's the problem. You'll just bliss out into unity. So, the Hebrews are a great contribution, even if in many ways they might be a little bit too heavy on the individuality side and could use a little bit more unity blended in. In the big scheme of the world, right, they offer some balance to, like, say, the Eastern concepts that, you know, go all unity fuzzy on you.
Yeah, and so when you bring out the father, you also then you have the son. I mean, in terms of if he's your father, then mm-hmm. you've got to be his son or daughter, depending on your...
Yeah.
And do you think that lasts all the way to when you finally meet him? I mean, do you think it really lasts all the way up through, as you become a spirit being and a owner, do you still think you have that father-son relationship concept? Or do you think it changes? Or do you think it's just... here, as they said here, because it was a concept that it's kind of like that, you know, that thing where it talks about it's not the truth or the reality or something, it's the vividness of its appeal, it's the simpleness of it. And this book continues to bring on the whole concept, you know, of the Father of God, Jesus did too. But as you grow, you still always think of God as your Father?
Yes, you do.
Oh, good.
And
it's not like,
remember how this works. You
it's not like that family thing gets.
You start out with a pretty solid sense to begin with, and then up through the local universe, they put that in more and more of a complete mother framing context, that father nucleus, and then, you know, you get to the point as you're graduating from the local universe where before you can bring in a lot more of the wholeness contextualizing, you need to amp up the father nucleus a little bit, because you don't want it to fuzz out. You know, because remember, that's kind of, you know, there's a little bit more than just the unity consciousness. We talked about that, how some of these people, you know, as they go kind of away from the father, they actually start to kind of get ideas that are mother-like. They aren't they aren't just going into continuumness. They could be just kind of more going to the whole and losing sight of the parts. Right? So, you know, they're bringing in kind of some other concepts. But it nonetheless, right, you know, no matter whether you're bringing in more unity or you're bringing in more wholeness, you can't let the parts diffuse and get lost in the vastness of the whole, say. So you do need to get kind of booster shots, if you will, as you ascend of, okay, we need to bring in a little bit more definitive solidification of your father part-likeness. Leaving as a first stage spirit makes you all the more a definitive part. Think about how your kind of a tenuous part, as long as you're a Marantxa, have a Marantxa body, you're very dependent upon those beings giving you a context and holding Marantxa substance together. You can't just like go running off with it. it'll unravel, right? So you're kind of only quasi individuated and kind of stand on your own two feet. You're kind of having to lean upon all those Marantxa power supervisors and stuff for holding your body together and stuff. You leave as a first stage spirit, so you leave that behind. It's like, no, I pretty much stand on my own two feet now. The spirit substance of the adjuster is my body. Okay. See, so you leave with this kind of new consecration of being an even more definitive part that can't get diffused into the bigger picture, because you're about to be put into a lot bigger context, right? You don't want the super universe vastness to just diffuse you, right? And eventually, you take firmly a hold of your absolute partness. You have an absolute dimension to your personality. Because eventually you have to be able to stand in the midst of the literalness of infinite deity, which will diffuse anything short of an absolute nugget. Right? So you need that ability to be absolutely be a part, because you don't want to be diffused into infinity by the functioning of infinite deity. I see. So the more you get the big picture brought into play, the more you do need kind of have a firmer grip on you as a part, and they give you appropriate. See, because once you leave as a first aid spirit and the adjuster is kind of your body, it isn't just that. But think about how much more immediate all the other aspects of the adjuster besides its substance, are part of you then. Yeah, that's true. As we've talked about, you start with your fusion, and you can just literally think of that as, here's you, and here's the adjuster, and it's just the two skins that are stuck together. But as you go up in the local universe, you more and more infuse until finally, right, you're completely within, right, and it's your body. The adjuster is your body. See, so you're more and more. You are intimately synchronized with the mindedness of the adjuster, not just the substantiveness of the adjuster. And see, you can only imagine how much, what that implies, what goes with that, the mindedness of the adjuster. Good grief. Right?
Yeah. Right, now, so even you become even more.
Yeah, think about how much more that mind knows it's the son of a father.
Yeah.
Right.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
Uh-oh, what would that look like?
Yeah, what would that look like? Yeah. Right, you can start to think about. Yeah.
So the personality is the is tied to the individuality, right? And the...
Yeah.
the jester is intimately related to the continuumness of spirit.
Yeah, it certainly initially is bringing in a lot of that spirit of goodness, right? It's bringing in that sort of purity of identification with unity.
And then, so then there's a mindedness, which is a super additive.
Okay. And your personality can encompass that homogenized mindedness because it's that transcendent. Right? And see,
but then you fuse by the time you become a spirit being. I
mean, well, yeah, well, this is way past fusion.
Way past
fusion. Yeah, right. But, you know, just, you know, remember that, you know, when you said it's the personality-related individuality, that, too, is going up the hierarchy. I mean, it starts out, you have some kind of individuality that seems to be basically independent of your personality. It's like, well, I'm a blob of protoplasm. I'm individuated, and I don't even need a personality for that, right? But more and more as you go up, like I was saying earlier, if you're going to maintain that individuality, because you're more and more in direct relationship to that which would diffuse you, so that personality more and more is why you're staying together, right? I mean, remember, it's giving you oneness, that personality. It's giving you indivisibility. See, right now, you know, molecular bonding, you know, is giving me quasi-indivisibility, right? I'm going to need something a lot more than that. You know, remember that you can try to bring a material structure with sort of groovy bonding into that region near the paradise deities, and what happens to material structures? Right, their individuality disappears, right? It's just fused, you know, into the functioning of infinite deity. Cannot stand as an individuality. So you're going to need something more than just some internal bonding, right, to hold yourself together when you go higher and higher. You're going to need something, right, from the source of oneness himself, right, to stand unmoved, undiffused, in the face of the functioning of ever higher deity. Yeah. Because you're going to walk into that, you know, you know, and you're not going to diffuse. It's because you're willed together. Not just, well, I guess I kind of just hold together whether I will it or not. No. More and more, it's all will, right? I mean, you don't even move from point A to point B on the Isle of Paradise, except by volition, by the exercise of will. And everything there is of that existential choice sort of nature.
You're describing that then. We have the same basic phenomena at work right now. If we don't have personality manifest, we tend to diffuse.
Look at you know, one of the mental diffusion phenomena we have, we call it psychosis, right? And that's because, you know, you're losing the holding togetherness of the personalized mind of the upper domain, right? And the lower domain starts to go off in all sorts of directions. It loses its order, it loses its bounding, right? And that's, see, again, you can discover how dependent you are as you mature on that personality being there, even if you're not aware of it in any conscious way. It's holding you together. Right? Your mind is, you know, well, the grace of this only goes so far in keeping your sanity. And then, yeah, if there wasn't a personality to hold things together, forget about it, about sanity. And if there's something going on that starts to bound, you know, your basic agitated mind away from that encompassment, that holding together, that indivisibility influence, right, Don't be surprised if you become quite divisible. Right? Maybe even you could describe it as being cut. Right? Schizophrenia. Right? He'll be cut into parts. Right?
Without it. There's so much pressure in the world today that I'm on the verge of psychosis and schizophrenia. Like on an hourly basis.
Is that what it is? Right. There's a lot of things that can tear you apart. See, and the personality, right, is transcendent of any influence, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Amadon didn't stand unmoved because his protoplasm was glued together better. Right?
Yeah, that's...
His personality was holding it together.
So. That's the answer.
Yep. All right. All right, I think we processed that one.
Yeah, that was fantastic. Let's go on with
including
it.
De-anthropomorphized. That's got a lot of letters. All right.
The concept of the personality of God, while clearly taught at Salem in the days of Melchizedek, was vague and hazy at the time of the first flight from Egypt, and only gradually evolved in the Hebraic mind from generation to generation in response to the teaching of the spiritual leaders. The perception of Yahweh's personality was much more continuous in its progressive evolution than was that of many other of the deity attributes. From Moses to Malachi, there occurred an almost unbroken ideational growth of the personality of God in the Hebrew mind. And this concept was eventually heightened and glorified by the teachings of Jesus about the Father in heaven.
Okay, so the whole the span of the whole Old Testament from Moses to Malachi. And you know, that's not just, well, that happens to be the so-called Book of Moses in the beginning and, you know, and Malachi at the end. I mean, that is the actual chronological span. Malachi is, you know, is at the end of the prophets, not just at the end of the Old Testament. You know, there in the 5th century B.C. Yeah, so, you know, a little bit after the exile.
They didn't use the word personality back then.
No, they didn't. Yeah, so, yeah. Notice we were talking about personality before. Huh, coincidentally. Look at how it's, that's what the next paragraph is all about. So what do they mean, the concept of the personality of God? You know, as you read it, it's like, well, it feels like it's a little bit more than just, you know, those Eastern peoples that don't have a personal God concept. You know, the way they're talking about it was much more continuous in its progressive evolution. It's like, okay, this is more than just he's a person, period, end of story. There's some sort of complexity here. What are they talking about by the personality of God? Well, one of the things is what we were just alluding to, that indivisibility. Right? The other is another basic thing to think of when you hear personality, think of purposing. And they have this growing recognition of how he is the source of purpose.
Constancy.
And, yeah, and constancy of purpose. Yeah, and that comes into play, too. We'll see that in the next section. But just, you know, the fact that there's purpose. Right? I mean, in the first principle of the Lucifer Manifesto, right. What was Lucifer rejecting? He was rejecting that there was any reality to a purpose to it all. Right. It was the nihilistic principle. Right. The nothingness that we're talking about there of nihilism is no purpose.
How could that be attractive?
It's attractive today.
Yeah. I mean, well, it's attractive. It's like, you know, if there isn't any purpose to the big picture, that leaves it free for my purposing to just take control of it all. Ooh, how exciting. I don't have to put myself in cooperative subordination to some greater purposing. It can be all about me, you know, and the extension of my purposing to the ends of infinity. Ooh, sounds exciting. Yeah. Right?
There's no purpose. I better supply that.
Right. See,
depending on
yeah, it's a good thing I exist. Yeah, yeah. All right.
Create the vacuum.
Right. Yeah. Right. So, but you see that, you know, that growing sense that those Hebrew people have had that there's a purpose, a greater purpose, an ever greater and greater and greater. It's an evolutionary, ever greater and greater and greater purpose. Right? There's a purpose to me. There's a purpose to my people. There's a purpose to all peoples. There's a, you know,
there's a great plan.
There's a great plan, right, in the mind of God. Right? Right, see, so that, definitely don't think what... Yeah, well, the run-of-the-mill person on the planet right now thinks when they see personality, they think temperament. No, okay? Throw all that out the window. Right? Don't think about the temperament of a self. Think about that transcendent top-down encompassing so that it holds it together and purposes it all to one end. Personal God. And if you're a son of that God, you're godlike in that regard. You can hold yourself together too, like he held himself together. And you can purpose your life just like he purposes everything. Getting that sense. Personal sense.
That manifesto ordering, is it nihilism, solipsism, anarchy?
No, the 1, 2, 3 of the principles is nihilism, anarchism, solipsism. Yes. And then, as I always point out, he gets into them 3, 2, 1. You know, one is the apex, you know, when you've gone to full cluelessness. Yeah. solipsism is easy to unwittingly stumble into. You got to, you know, lean into it a little bit more to get to anarchism and then to nihilism. All right. Let's see. Anything else that we want to point out? I guess just, why the preface in general? I already kind of pointed that out. I mean, just, you know, they're spending so much time on the Hebrews. Not because, oh, well, whoever wrote this book, you know, has a real Bible bias or something like that. No. I mean, they want to try to point out just how important this evolution of the God concept, the Hebrew, was for the entire world to not just fuzz out into some intangible, Brahman-like thing.
Plus, right? It led up to their Melchizedek's whole purpose, just set the stage for Jesus.
Right, yeah. See, and of course that's the corollary. Say, oh, gee, I wonder if it's a coincidence then that Melchizedek came, and the Melchizedek receivers fostered all these prophets, and that Jesus came. It's like, no, because, right, if you're going to reveal the individual called the Universal Father, you've got to have a people that are holding on solidly to an individual and a personalized individual at that, right? Someone who's off in the fuzz that's difficult. Okay, so it's Hebrew. The evolution of God concept among the Hebrews is a very important thing for all the world to benefit from.
Section 1, Samuel, first of the Hebrew prophets. Hostile pressure of the surrounding peoples in Palestine soon taught the Hebrew sheikhs that they could not hope to survive unless they confederated their tribal organizations into a centralized government. And this centralization of administrative authority afforded a better opportunity for Samuel to function as a teacher and a reformer.
Okay, so just a couple things. First of all, the title, Samuel's the first of the Hebrew prophets. You know, we already saw he's not the first of the prophets, but he's the first of the Hebrew prophets. And you know, we already alluded to this with the sheikhs. You know, basically your tribal warlords, chiefs, what have you, sort of concept. They need a king, right? We need to move things forward to a monarchical construct here. So Samuel, as I think everyone knows, plays a big role in that, in getting Saul
kingmaker,
right? As kingmaker, Saul and then David, right? Solomon that follows that, right? So to get that, to get more of a nation with a king going, okay. So they're telling you that up front. It's like, whoa, it sounds like this is going to have a lot to do with issues besides religion. Yeah, there's a lot of political aspect to this progressing phenomenon. Yeah, as they were saying there. Afforded a better opportunity for Samuel to function as a teacher and reformer. All right, there's this limited opportunity, in a random tribal morass. Yeah. So, like we said, Moses was successful because he brought in lots of material pragmatism and brought some order and greater structure, because in that you have this potential for the more refined, subtle elements of the inner life to play out. When the outer life is chaos, right? I mean, you can't get to the inner life. Right? So it's very important. all right.
Samuel sprang from a long line of the Salem teachers who had persisted in maintaining the truths of Melchizedek as a part of their worship forms. This teacher was a virile and resolute man. Only his great devotion, coupled with his extraordinary determination, enabled him to withstand the almost universal opposition which he encountered when he started out to turn all Israel back to the worship of the supreme Yahweh of Mosaic times. And even then, he was only partially successful. He went back to the service of the higher concept of Yahweh, only the more intelligent half of the Hebrews. The other half continued in the worship of the tribal gods of the country and in the baser conceptions of Yahweh.
Okay, so you can already kind of see between the lines, virile and resolute, extraordinary determination. Right. The boy's not going to beat around the bushes with a lot of things. He's going to take a very direct approach to whipping them into shape. People are going to die. Right, this first prophet is not some arbitrary person that the Melchizedeks are fostering. Right, Samuel sprang from a long line of the Salem teachers that persisted in maintaining the truths of Melchizedek. So, even though what Melchizedek did directly while he was alive wasn't enough, and they're having to do this very aggressive prophetizing, if you will, modality of engagement, Machaventus still provided the context for that. To have someone that's prophetizable, to say it that way, right? You know, the run-of-the-mill person, you can't uplift them a little bit, focus them a little bit, if their mind is just really not focusable, upliftable. Right? You need some priming of the pump. And so Machaventus' efforts, supplied that, if nothing else. Let's see, anything else there? Almost universal opposition. Right. Everyone is going to be against him for 1,001 reasons, because everyone is See, there's been plenty of time for everyone to settle into a nice, cozy relationship. You know, the established order and its elites and everything. It's all, everyone's got all their I's dotted and T's crossed. And yeah, you know, and he's going to just, you know, he's got to try to upset the entire structure and to change it. So he's going to face opposition from every quarter. Nonetheless, genetics is genetics, as they're saying towards the end there. The lesser peoples, you know, mindily, because of their genetics, you know, he's not going to have much success with them. But, you know, if he has a solid, upper class of society and a core leadership, right, those are people that are going somewhere. Right? God can do something with that phenomenon.
Samuel was a
rough... Wait, hold on. Wait, you got something?
So John's question is, are the Hebrews holding a place in their mixed genetics that the Andites once held? Andonites once held.
Well, we talked about there was... it helped some that there was a diversity of genetics occasionally produced a person then that could really kind of be brought together, you know, as more of a Andonite-like innately harmonized phenomenon. Obviously, it also was going to produce some people with lots of cross currents and stuff too. That can be kind of part of the differential they were just talking about, you know, whether or not that diversity can be brought together, or if it's just, you know, making the person having a multiplicity of ways that he's at war with himself. There's a reason why we have all of these races, because the point is to have a much greater super summative possibility, you know, with all that diversity. So, yeah.
Samuel was a rough and ready type of man, a practical reformer who could go out in one day with his associates and overthrow a score of Baal sites. The progress he made was by sheer force of compulsion. He did little preaching, less teaching, but he did act. One day he was mocking the priest of Baal, the next chopping in pieces a captive king. He devotedly believed in the one God, and he had a clear concept of that one God as creator of heaven and earth. Quote, "The pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and he has set the world upon them," unquote.
Yeah. So there you see what I was talking about. Rough and ready.
Seems practical. You could do 20 different things in one day, but okay. They must have been awful close together.
You know, and just look at, the point they're trying to make. I mean, he doesn't just kill someone. He needs to make a point, a very clear point, right? He chops them into pieces, right? To just make the point that there is no integrity embodied in this individual. Right? Nothing like the integrity that comes from the real God, right? As you were just talking about. Right? He's a person. He's indivisible. And the people who identify with that indivisible God are likewise indivisible. Look at this person who doesn't identify. Look at how multiply dividable he is. I've got 600 pieces of him right in front of you. Right? See, he's very overt because he's dealing with people that can't think abstractly. Right? They need something very literal and direct.
Right? Mocking the priest.
It just went to pieces, right?
Wow. Right. So, and he is a great prophet. Yeah, this is a, you can see how important it is to remind us of this. Like I was saying, the kind of state that mankind has gotten themselves in, that we're so wishy-washy and, you know, it's like, I don't know, that's kind of mean. And, you know, it's like, you know, okay, would you call this mean? Yes, yeah, slightly. He's a prophet of God, a great prophet, a founding prophet. A joy to the Melchizedek receivers. Right? I mean, there's a reason why they're reminding us of this stuff, right? And saying things so directly, you know, so you don't have to go to the Old Testament. It's like, I wonder if that was real where he chopped that king to pieces. It's like, no, really. Okay.
This is also a very uncivilized context in general.
Right? Yes, it is.
We're more civilized. That has benefits, too. Like, we don't...
Yes, it does. We don't have to go... But... Right. Even though you may not have to go to the substance of this, but you know, as we get deeper in the endarkment, you might have to get to the substance of this again. But you at least need to embody the essence of this, right? You have to have both material pragmatism and spiritual idealism, right? It's not some sort of idealistic terror that's causing him to chop into pieces. Like I was just explaining, it's a very practical thing, right? He needs to literally demonstrate the divisibility of this person in relationship to their God, or maybe their so-called God. God has joined together, no man can put asunder. Okay, he says that, but I just put him asunder, did I not? Right? Yeah, he's demonstrating that.
You know, there's a direct correlation to today in that there's some ideas you can't compromise with those ideas. They just have to be defeated. They can't be accommodated. They can't be ignored. You know, let's just get a
little... We'll pretend that won't break anything.
disagree but get along, you know. No, you have to defeat. It has to be defeated. You can't give quarter.
Yeah. It's like, oh no, tribalism is just as advanced as nationalism. No, it's not. Period. Right? Like I said, I mean, we have to get back to some of that. You cannot allow things that, you know, in a sense are antisocial. Right? And the higher the society gets, the more advanced the society gets, the subtler those antisocial facts are. Right? In an early time, it's totally in the noise and irrelevant. But in a very advanced stage, right, that's all catastrophic. Like I tried to point out, just think genetically. Right? I mean, there's not a single one of us that would be allowed to procreate in a world settled in light life. I mean, we're just so grotesque biologically. Not even remotely, would be allowed to procreate. I mean, they're at the levels of removing defectives and stuff, you know, that we don't even, it's five orders of magnitude in the noise right now for us. We can't even imagine something like that being considered bad, right? All right. But in those times, right, they've eliminated all the coarse stuff, and they're now working, with a very fine sieve, right? And they're sifting out things that, we would call them the greatest biologic specimen alive today, and they're thrown in the garbage can, in advanced age. So, I mean, this is all relative.
I have to address Jane's point.
Yeah.
We're not defeating what is against Western civilization, for instance. And one of the reasons is because no one worldwide is using weapons. And, like, that's such a hard-line view, but it goes along with what we're reading.
Yeah.
But once in a while, I say it.
Yeah, and like I was pointing out, I mean, this is the thing that's... The more we let civilization unravel, right, the more difficult it's going to be, because, to get it back, you're going to have to start to do some pretty darn aggressive things if you let it slip too far.
We need Samuel.
Right? I mean, those early... British kings, you know, were they all soft and fuzzies? They were trying to whip the tribes into a nation? No, they were ruthlessly aggressive, because you can't get to a nation any other way. If you let it slip far enough, you got to use some really harsh measures to get it back again. So it's like, you know, we need to decide if that's what we want to let it get to that point where, like, civil war is the only solution, or do you want to try to do something a little more civilized now, right? Yeah, some decisions need to be made at some point here. All right, but this whole bit with Baal, you know, that we won't get to that, you know, as we're running out of time tonight, but you know, that'll be one of the big subjects next week. You know, we'll see how that all fits in, what the issue is at play with these believers or followers of Baal. Let's see, anything else there? Just a clear concept of that one God, so you have the one part, and remember Creator. And how important that was, you know, that he's not just, you know, the God that does favors for you, right? He's a Creator God. And that's in a very important Melchizedek edition, and Creator of heaven and earth to boot. Right?
But the great contribution which Samuel made to the development of the concept of deity was his ringing pronouncement that Yahweh was changeless, forever the same embodiment of unerring perfection and divinity. In these times, Yahweh was conceived to be a fitful God of jealous whims, always regretting that he had done thus and so. But now, for the first time since the Hebrews sallied forth from Egypt, they heard these startling words, quote, "The strength of Israel will not lie, nor repent, for he is not a man that he should repent," unquote. Stability in dealing with divinity was proclaimed. Samuel reiterated the Melchizedek covenant with Abraham and declared that the Lord God of Israel was the source of all truth, stability, and constancy. Always had the Hebrews looked upon their God as a man, a superman, an exalted spirit of unknown origin, but now they heard the one-time spirit of Horeb exalted as an unchanging God of creator perfection. Samuel was aiding the evolving God concept to ascend to heights above the changing state of men's minds and the vicissitudes of mortal existence. Under his teaching, the God of the Hebrews was beginning the ascent from an idea on the order of the tribal gods to the ideal of an all-powerful and changeless creator and supervisor of all creation.
Okay, all kinds of stuff in that great big paragraph. Okay, so let's start with that first italicized word, changeless. Right, I mean, we need Samuel again, still today. I mean, there's almost not a single person on the planet that can hold on definitively, including your Yerenshiva greeters, right, to the recognition that God is changeless, period. There's never been a prayer, there never will be a prayer that will change God one iota. Right? Just, I mean, see, that's between the lines. You know, prayer has always been a big issue. Samuel's saying, God you're praying to is changeless. And everyone's going, well, what the hell is the point of prayer then?
Just to understand what God
is. Right? It just, it turns prayer on its head the moment you make God changeless. Great. You got to completely rethink what prayer is about. It's not that there isn't genuine prayer, but it's not what you thought it was. Right? Because it's tied to a changeless God. Right, so that's huge.
I think he got that idea from Melchizedek.
Right, it's like it's, you know, it's it's the priming of Melchizedek plus the help. You know, he's a prophet, so there's some helping with bringing his mind to a focus. We don't know the details of it, right? But it's helping to bring that to a focus. Plus, we all, you know, have the ability to kind of recognize that, sync up with that, focus on that by our encirclement of the Holy Spirit.
You didn't have the loving Heavenly Father part.
Right. I mean, yeah, remember, oh, yeah, I mean, we didn't emphasize that. What did it say there? The progress he made was by sheer force of compulsion. He did little preaching, less teaching. Right? But he did act.
when it talked about the half that responded and the half that didn't, mm-hmm. it was probably the half that didn't. Probably didn't have adjusters.
Right, there's always that problem,
the
too.
The same problem a lot Jesus of
them,
had.
Yeah, a lot of them wouldn't have adjusters, you know, just adding to the complexity of it, yeah. Yeah, that makes it really difficult to bring someone to a focus if they don't have an adjuster inside as that focusing mechanism. Okay, so changeless. I mean, you need to constantly work against your natural mind. You know, you should wake up every morning and remind yourself that the real God is changeless. Right? Let that set the context for the day. Right? Because
and everything else is nothing but change.
Yeah, right. Which is all. Because there's a peace to be found in that. Right?
That's true.
God is changeless. Just set the stage for your day with that. Right? The first prophet of the Hebrews set the stage, right? Okay, step one, guys, God is changeless. We're not going to get anywhere if you've got this whimsical, anthropomorphic God notion in your head. Right? You know, and of course, if he's changeless, like they're pointing out, that's immediately lifting him up out of the plane, and he's becoming transcendent, as they're saying there towards the end of that paragraph. Samuel was aiding the evolving God concept to ascend, see transcendent, ascend to heights above the changing state of men's minds and the vicissitudes of mortal existence. As I've tried to stress, the fifth epical revelation is trying to take that, the idea of God all the way to that and get you to logically recognize that, you know, if he's changeless, what that fundamentally means is he's has no experiential nature. He's purely existential. Right? Because if there's an experiential nature, that is synchronized with change. To be absolutely changeless, he has to be absolutely existential. And to let it fully sink in. And notice, too, kind of in the middle of that paragraph, there's some philosophic framing going on. That the Lord God of Israel was the source of all truth, stability, and constancy. See, that's philosophic thought, right? Not religious thought. Right? So there's a framing, a philosophic framing of the religiosity of this God concept that he's putting forward.
Sounds pretty advanced for that time, day and time.
Yes, it does.
And well, it's a challenge. How, having a changing mind all the time, how do I have a relationship with something that's
changeless?
I mean, it's one thing to think about it, but to have a relationship to it?
Yeah, so you go, well, logically, it's impossible. My changing part can't have a relationship to a changeless fact. So the only, but I think that I somehow can have a relationship. Oh, the changeless God must have given me a measure of changelessness, and I need to find my changelessness nucleus that's like him and can relate to him. Right? I need to find my personality that's changeless, like him, because it's of him. Right? It's an individuation of part of his deity, right? And it's changeless. right? And it's that objective observer point in you, that existential point. It has no experiences, just is. That part of you relates to him. You need to find that part of you. You to find that which, you know, as I was saying, that's above the changing state of men's minds and the vicissitudes of mortal existence, you know, there's a part of you that's above all that, just like he is. You need to find that, right? And when you stand on that, you have peace that passes all understanding. That's the whole point. Find the part that he gave you that's like him, because nothing else can relate to him. No matter how transcendent the experience, it has no relationship to him. Yeah. Only that which is purely existential can relate to him.
It does through his sons, though.
Right. There's a whole downstepping mechanism there. That it, yeah.
Which we have, we can relate to now.
Yeah, and that's a very important thing that comes out right before Jesus is arrested. Right, when you go from the purely existential fact of I am that I am. Remember we were talking about purposing with personality? What does the that and I am that I am mean? Yeah. You say I am, it's like, oh, okay, so you exist. Well, what's the purpose of your existence? I am that I am. The purpose of my existence is to exist, period. Right? And he in and of himself can't do anything but just that. And if you're going to get something besides that, the Universal Father has to be downstepped, like through the experiential deity of a Creator Son, so that you can say, yeah, I am the bread of life, I am the living water, I am, you know, that whole long list of I ams, right? That's not the Creator Son, that's the Universal Father made manifest experientially through the conduit of the Creator Son. Right? You know, the I of the I am the bread of life, that I is the Universal Father, not the Creator Son. You know, and the trick is it appears to be the Creator Son, but you have to know it really isn't. That's the point of that section in the book, is to explain to you that finally, you know, if the Universal Father had an experiential nature, it could be described like that. Okay. That's the Universal Father's purely existential nature downstepped into an experiential phenomenon. But it's his nature, right? The Universal Father's nature, not the Creator Son's nature.
For all intents and purposes, you know that paragraph.
Yeah. Of course.
What you're saying is the opposite, because he is.
Right.
For now.
The appearance is, but you know, again, the whole point is eventually. Right, the event, you know, eventually you want to recognize that none of us have any concept of what the purposing of the Creator Son is. Right, when he was here, he set his purposing aside. Right, and is just manifesting the purposing of the Universal Father. I mean, wonder what his purposing is like. You know, what if I see him? And, you know, instead of that, he who has seen me has seen the Father. I mean, what about seeing him? I mean, eventually, you'll at least when you get to Salvington, you'll actually get to know his purposing, absolutely independent of the Father's purposing or the Son's purposing or one of the Master Spirit's purposing or whatever, right? I mean, there's 700,000 of those unique purposings, none of which are the purposing of the Father. Wow. Is the universe not complicated?
Well, yeah, that's something to look forward to, yeah. But we have a long time before that happens.
Yeah. But it's just, you know, it's kind of important to make sure that you don't stall out in Jesus, right? Let Jesus be the way to get to a deeper recognition of the Universal Father.
Well, as natives of Nebadon, will we carry that purposing out into the super universe and beyond?
Yeah, right. See, you inescapably leave the local universe with some of his purposing flavor. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and that gets eventually that gets incorporated into a very complex acquirement, so that you when you go out in that second phase of your finite career, and you'll say, "He who has seen me has seen the Mother." Right, and you know, as you're going up to the local universe, you're acquiring, you know, a measure of that. You know, you're never going to be saying, "He who has seen me has seen the Father." Right, you know, you're right now you're God the Father seeking, but you're not God the Father acquiring. You're God the Mother acquiring. Right, the snowball is rolling, acquiring that, and when you go out in that second phase, right? See, it's you know, you go out from paradise, God the Mother revealing. He went out from paradise, God the Father revealing. Right, this is a dual completeness. Right, you have, you know, you don't have to go out revealing the Father, that's covered, but going out revealing the Mother is not covered, right, by Creator Sons. I mean, right now, you know, he's in his second phase, and he's God the Mother acquiring. Eventually, in the Absinite Age, he can reveal the Mother at a higher level.
So he's a Creator Son. He has a measure of the Father.
Right, just innately, existentially in him, yeah. And so he can just, you know, day one, he can go out, he embodies Father-type deity. And remember, technically, when he's in his seventh bestowal here, he's not directly revealing the will of the Universal Father. He's revealing the will of the Universal Father downstepped in the First Master Spirit, right? So that has some relationship to the grand universe, right? You know, and right, but obviously, you know, effectively, it is the Universal Father. Just as you were saying, I mean, you can't get to the First Master Spirit level of the Father. Now, you can't even get to the Supreme Father level of the Father. I mean, Jesus, you know, our Master Son embodies everything that you can imagine of the Father right now.
When should we stop stalling out on Jesus?
Well,
like now?
I mean, but again, remember, you're not setting Jesus aside. You're adding the Universal Father to Jesus. Jesus, yes. And, right, that's the problem of Christianity. It's Jesus and then we're done. It's like, no, Jesus and the Universal Father. You're forgetting to add the Universal Father. You're just getting, you're making a Jesus-ism. You're making him a complete lifestyle solution.
If you read the book, you're not doing that.
Add the Universal Father to Jesus.
Yeah. By reading the book, we do that. So.
Yeah. That's the important thing. Use Jesus kind of in and of himself, as they say, of all human knowledge, that which is greatest value is to know the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it, because of how much that can help you as a mortal animal origin creature live a better life, find your potential. Right, so Jesus in and of himself has a great value to as Jesus the man, like the first section of paper 196 tells you. But then the other part of Jesus, right, go through him to the Universal Father, so that you have both of them. All that Jesus can offer you as a human, and all God can offer you as a potential finaliter. I put the two together. That's what the fifth epoch of Revelation is trying to correct. You know, that's where the apostles, you know, the day of Pentecost, they tell you they veered off on an unfortunate tangent away from that, right? And it all ended up being Jesus only. It's like, no, Jesus and. They forgot about the and part. That's the mistake they made. They tell you, right after the Spirit of Truth is bestowed, that's the part they lost. They got the Jesus part, you know, and the Jesus part has benefited Western civilization greatly for 2,000 years. But now you need to have Jesus and the Universal Father, And we can go further than we've gone so far.
It's funny because before Jesus came, they had that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
They didn't have Jesus, obviously.
It was easier to have God the Father when you didn't have the incredible, fascinating object of Jesus right there, too, right? You're kind of ending up pushing God aside.
So they almost threw out the baby with the
yes. Yeah. See, that's another reason why they're getting this. Like, remember, right? There's it's not just Jesus, it's also the Father.
Yeah. One more point. We do go through him for a long time.
To yes. Yeah.
All the way till
Salvington. Yes, we do.
So,
yeah. We're very dependent upon that conduit until we leave Salvington. Yeah.
So it makes for a beautiful relationship that I plan to never give up.
Yeah. And even remember, even beyond the local universe, the Spirit of Truth goes with you. So you're still using him in essence, right, to go to greater things. I mean, he's a very important part of the picture, but it's just
yeah. It's a little simplistic, though, to think that the errors of Pentecost could have been different. There's an inevitability
to it. Of course.
Because going up, you have to have a foundation. If you don't have that foundation, you can't go straight up.
Right.
You're going to immediately turn to the side. And it takes time to establish a foundation whereby then you can find a way to go up.
Right. It doesn't say that the apostles were damned because of their mistake.
Yeah.
It doesn't change the fact they made a mistake. It's a mistake.
Well, I think of the civil rights movement and what that meant. And that seems like, well, why didn't we just go straight up from there?
Yeah.
Instead, we brought in affirmative action, reverse racism. And it's like, yeah, why?
You got to work it into the system. And right, the whole evolutionary process is complicated. Yeah. Right. So that's yeah. And Terry's just trying to make sure that we don't lose sight of how important evolutionarily, developmentally, the fact of Jesus is. Right? You're not going to get to the Universal Father without him. He's indispensable to the process. And so all of that is a solid given. But just remember that, don't forget about the Universal Father. He has something to offer you as well that Jesus can't offer you directly. Right? Where Jesus is just a way through which the Father offers that. But it's the Father that's offering you that. Right? And so benefit from the Universal Father through Jesus and benefit from Jesus directly. Put the two together. All right.
That was quite the tangent.
Oh, one other thing. There's another italicized thing before we leave. Right at the end there. All-powerful and changeless creator and supervisor of all creation. Why do they italicize that? Well, it goes with the changeless thing. It's like, oh, if he's changeless, okay, well, he's not monkeying around with all the details in time then. Well, how do I think about his relationship? Oh, he's overseeing. He's supervising. Right? You can say it in Latin, supervisor, or you can say it in Northern European, overseer. Either way, it's the same word. Right? Instead of thinking of him down in the plane, like you're saying, Machiavelli was trying to get, lift him up. Okay, so now he's not someone who is, satisfying your wishes and desires and whatnot in the plane. And he's changeless up there, and so he's just overseeing. Work with that. Start to, it's like, well, what does that imply? I don't even want to flesh that out right now, but that's the point. That's a inescapable consequence of assuming he's changeless. You recognize, oh, that means he's just a supervisor then, not a micromanager.
He's changeless, but he's a creator. Not just creation isn't something that's one and done.
Yeah.
It's an ongoing process.
He's an existential contextualizer, right? All right. He's a supervisor, all right?
And he preached anew the story of God's sincerity, his covenant-keeping reliability, said Samuel. The Lord will not forsake his people. He has made with us an everlasting covenant, ordered in all things and sure. And so throughout all Palestine, there sounded the call back to the worship of the Supreme Yahweh. Ever this energetic teacher proclaimed, "You are great, O Lord God, for there is none like you, neither is there any God beside you."
Okay, so definitely, you know, at the very least pushing henotheism, right, if not all the way to monotheism. And notice again, right in the middle there, ordered in all things. See how important it is? He's got that material pragmatism. Right, the thing that Akhenaten, you know, didn't have enough of, and that's why he, you know, he had the issues that he had. So we see this over and over again. Someone is consequential in a more lasting way when they approach things with cosmic consciousness. And that's the psychic circles, right? It's greater and greater cosmic consciousness. Not just merely spiritual consciousness, but cosmic consciousness. So here we see it over and over again.
Theretofore, the Hebrews had regarded the favor of Yahweh mainly in terms of material prosperity. It was a great shock to Israel and almost cost Samuel his life when he dared to proclaim, quote, "The Lord enriches and impoverishes. He debases and exalts. He raises the poor out of the dust and lifts up the beggars to set them among princes to make them inherit the throne of glory," unquote. Not since Moses had such comforting promises for the humble and the less fortunate been proclaimed, and thousands of despairing among the poor began to take hope that they could improve their spiritual status.
And there is the key. It started out with material prosperity, and then it was spiritual status. He's subtly getting them to shift. It's like, oh, well, wait a minute. You're saying that God is not a material technique, but you're saying he raises the poor out of the dust and lifts up the beggars, et cetera. Well, what do you mean? If he's not a material technique, what do you mean by raises the poor? No, not materially, spiritually. They're still poor. But spiritually, they've been lifted up. Right. See, so how clever it is, see, that he's the way he's approaching it. You know, he's not trying to explain it. He's just stating some things. And if people are going, "Oh, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. What does he mean by that?" Trying to get him to reflect and sort that out. The only way that could make sense is if there's something besides matter that is, you know, that you're going up relative to. Because he's saying you're going up, but you're not going up relative to matter. It's like, actually, the only possibility is that there's something other way that you can go up. So that's you know, just a great technique.
Almost cost him his life.
Yeah, but you know, it was very cherished, right? It's like, you know, the guy that sent all his harem home. You know, and so the parents, you know, sat upon him and killed him. Right, it's very difficult to shift the moray scheme, right, that people have built up, and you know, they've submitted to the fact, well, I guess I'm just, you know, I'm lowly, and that's because God doesn't favor me. I accept that. Right? He's upsetting the whole scheme that's predicated on that concept of relationship to God.
But Samuel did not progress very far beyond the concept of a tribal god. He proclaimed a Yahweh who made all men but was occupied chiefly with the Hebrews, his chosen people. Even so, as in the days of Moses, once more the God concept portrayed a deity who is holy and upright. Quote, "There is none as holy as the Lord. Who can be compared to this holy Lord God?" Unquote.
Okay, so it just, that's all relatively straightforward, but just kind of notice the first part there, you know, baby steps. Don't try to do everything all in one, you know, big step. He didn't need to progress very far beyond the concept of a tribal God. He's just the first prophet, right? And all of us are just, yeah, a first step in a very long process. And do that first step well. Trust the subsequent steps to those who go after you.
As the years passed, the grizzled old leader progressed in the understanding of God, for he declared, quote, "The Lord is a God of knowledge, and actions are weighed by him. The Lord will judge the ends of the earth, showing mercy to the merciful, and with the upright man he will also be upright." Unquote. Even here is the dawn of mercy, albeit it is limited to those who are merciful. Later he went one step further when, in their adversity, he exhorted his people, quote, "Let us fall now into the hands of the Lord, for his mercies are great. There is no restraint upon the Lord to save many or few." Unquote.
It's getting more and more universalized in conception. And so this, you know, as I was saying about, you know, first step first, you know, next step after, it's the same way inside of you, right? Take the first steps, and there will be subsequent steps. Right? He doesn't have to get the fullness of the concept of a merciful God to, you know, in the first step. The God of growth within you will get you there. How does it levels of meaning go? Right? Is the first level of meaning the level of mercy? No. First just, next fair, right, et cetera, right? Just, fair, patient, kind, then merciful. Right? You got to move up. So, you know, starts with justice, and eventually you'll get to mercy, and then you can put the love cherry on top.
And this gradual development of the concept of the character of Yahweh continued under the ministry of Samuel's successors. They attempted to present Yahweh as a covenant-keeping God, but hardly maintained the pace set by Samuel. They failed to develop the idea of the mercy of God as Samuel had later conceived it. There was a steady drift back toward the recognition of other gods. Despite the maintenance that Yahweh was above all, quote, "Yours is the kingdom, O Lord, and you are exalted as head above all," unquote.
So I'm getting the sense that there's probably going to be more than just one prophet. Right? Yeah. You can see it just, you know, it just pumps it up and then it drifts back down. It's going to get pumped up again. And it'll, you know, so you're going to have this sawtooth phenomenon, right, going forward.
The keynote of this era was divine power. The prophets of this age preached a religion designed to foster the king upon the Hebrew throne. Quote, "Yours, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty. In your hands is power and might, and you are able to make great and to give strength to all." Unquote. And this was the status of the God concept during the time of Samuel and his immediate successors.
So it works hand in hand. Right. See, one of the ways that the evolutionary process moves political phenomena forward is leveraging off the God concept. Samuel and as you said, those that follow him, didn't shy away from, you know, mixing the two together. You go, well, wait, where's separation of church and state? It's like, well, early on, you can't have church and state separated. All right, that's a refinement that comes way down the road. But, you know, you have to have kings and churches kind of closely tied to begin with, right? The energy that the king needs is, you know, is by leveraging off of the God, you know, the concept of God and his relationship to the nation. So seeing that, you know, how Samuel very much, you know, understood that and presented God that way.
The king has to be favored by God. Right. Or he wouldn't be king.
Right, right. The only way, I mean, it's hard enough to keep a king from, you know, from not being stabbed in the back instantly. Right, you got to put a little bit of fear of God in people's minds, you know, so you can get them to live more than 5 minutes, if nothing else. Right, this is all those practical issues. I'll just say, you know, to sum up again, you know, it's going to be like this as we continue to read forward. This there's so much to be reminded of that we knew at one time, like you were pointing out, but we've lost sight of whether it's, you know, don't forget about the universal Father, or don't forget all of the material pragmatism issues, and, you know, and that there's a philosophy to government and whatnot too. I mean, all that stuff has to be considered. That's why the Urantia book covers everything that it does, because right? You need the full package deal if you're going to be something besides just a primitive natural phenomenon. You just can't do it with a few of the parts. You need the whole set of parts for it to work. And so it's a great challenge to face the content of the Urantia book. You know, you may be open to being challenged about God, you know, or say about your concept of Jesus. You know, maybe he's not the atonement, the embodiment of the atonement doctrine or whatever. Maybe you're open to a couple things there, but are you open to having your political thoughts really challenged? Are your scientific thoughts really challenged? You know, et cetera. If you're not, you're not going to get very far.
Or your prayer thoughts?
Yeah, your prayer thoughts really challenged, right? Yeah, some of those things that, you know, get really, really dicey.
I can't pray for that.
Right, it's a stiff hill to climb, right, to engage the Urantia book, and it's just not going to be many that are open to across the board challenge like that. We have to just recognize that it's not a dispensational revelation. So just like with Samuel, only a few could handle his challenge. The others, no, and it's going to be even more so that only a few, you know, will handle a challenge like this. Okay.
A few in a world of
big numbers is still a lot of people. Yes, we don't want to ever forget the...
A goodly number.
Yes, it will be a goodly number. Okay, let's take a moment, everyone.